everyone. Welcome to another binary episode of the Day Zero podcast. I'm Spectre, with me is Z. Today we have a mix of topics, including a Ghostscript RCE Windows registry issue, and a follow-up to the SecurePoint UTM blog post we covered yesterday. Some of you might remember we hinted towards that on yesterday's episode, if you were around for that. There's also an Apple phone and a few other topics there. Just as a heads up for those who might have missed it last week, I put out two blog posts on our site on reversing the AMD platform security processor. I don't remember if I've really talked about it too much on the stream. I think I might have alluded to it at one point when we were covering some firmware security topics. But yeah, it's been a bit of a side project that I've been working on. The secure processor, for those who haven't read the blog post and aren't really aware of it, it basically exists in all AMD CPUs, and it's quite a like essential component to how they function, as well as like modern chains of trust. So yeah, check it out if that sounds like something interesting to you. You know, just giving a quick self promo at the top of the episode, but yeah, I won't go into it too much there. It's there if you want to read it. Yeah, so with that out of the way, I'll let Z get into the Spot the Vuln for the week.
Yeah, this week's Spot the Vuln was based on a vulnerability we actually covered on the last binary episode, where there was some SN printf weirdness going on. So in this case, what we've got is this create note function, very classic demo code, you know, a note-taking application. Takes in, you know, note title, note body, has a define here for the buffer size. Does what you'd expect there, checks string length of the note body, you know, make sure the note isn't too big, does an allocation for the buffer size, tracks buffer start, then starts writing data into the buffer using snprintf. So with that, it's keeping track buff size equal, or sorry, remaining equals buff size, so it knows how many bytes are remaining to be written. Every time smprintf returns, it's giving the number of bytes that's done, so it tracks both the position in the buffer and the remaining number of bytes. It, you know, does some fancy stuff with the time to add that in there, you know, prints that in again, keeps track. I've seen code like this before. It's nothing too crazy here, maybe not for note-taking, but, you know, you're tracking how many bytes are being used there. The problem comes down to the fact that snprintf is a little bit weird in terms of its output. Snprintf will return the number of bytes it wrote to the buffer, but it will also return the number of bytes it would have written to the buffer had the buffer been large enough. It doesn't indicate to you like, oh, this buffer was too big. Or the way it indicates that to you is the fact that its return value will be larger than the, in this case, that remaining count with that kind of n or limit that you give it. When the return value is larger than that, that's basically telling you I didn't write this much data, but I would have written this much data. And so somebody who isn't aware of that fact, of the fact that I won't like throw an error, throw something weird going on, or even if it just returned like at the kind of right to the remaining point, saying it didn't write anywhere further than that, this kind of would have worked out. But when it goes over, so you get a value that is greater than remaining, and it does this minus equals or subtracts the amount of bytes written or would have been written, sorry. It'll basically int overflow. You go negative. You end up with a very large value that it'll allow to write in the next write, so you can have you know, right beyond the expected bounds, basically. So basically, same thing happened on the last episode when we did talk about it. So I kind of took inspiration from that vulnerability for this one. It's just a bit of a weirdness with snprintf, because when you do use like sprintf, it gives you exactly how many bytes were written. There's none of this kind of weirdness going on with potentially returning a larger value. Although this weirdness is something that's kind of understood. It's a common trick to get the size of a dynamic string by providing like zero as the number of bytes, and then it just returns the size it would have written, and you can allocate space for that. But yeah, I don't know. It's a bit of a weirdness with SMPrintf that you have to be aware of and can easily make this sort of mistake.
All right, so getting into topics, up first from Almond Consulting, we have Shell and the Ghost. Ghost Script RCE, and I'll let Z get into this one.
And this was a, I thought it was a pretty fun bug that they kind of came across. I guess I say that quite a bit, but they include a fair bit of background here about Ghost Script, about some of the structures involved. Ultimately, the bug, they had this Ghost Script that just called filter a lot. I kept calling like BCP encode filter, LZW encode, just a ton of filters over and over and over. And eventually they had some crash. So this was found through fuzzing. They talk a little bit about that, going with some sort of a grammar mutator for their fuzzing. Doesn't go too deep into their fuzzing. You can see they're just using AFL on this. But they come with this crash. It's calling filter a bunch. The way filters work are you can effectively just, you can imagine it's like putting a layer on top of your input or output or on top of like a file. You know, usually this is, we're dealing with processing file or user input stuff. So you'll have a filter, it'll have a read pointer and output pointer. Usually it defaults off to like a 2048 byte buffer, I think, is being used. That's not super important here, but, You have the chain of filters coming on, so as you write, then it'll keep track of function pointers to like the next filter in the chain. They'll call it with whatever's left in your buffer and kind of keep passing it along the chain. So you read your input buffer is the output of the filter before yours, and you just kind of have that filter chain going on. So this is just passing through or passing the data through several filters. So in theory, the idea is you would apply your encoding through some filter and then write it out to a file. So what they found was a bug inside of the Adobe Binary Communication Protocol, or the tagged Adobe Binary Communication Protocol. Both of these relied on this stream state function. And actually, if you take a look, they set up some of the debugging messages to see what was happening. And that kind of hints towards some of the oddness that happens or what the root cause of the bug is. As you see in this output here, they've got the write process being called. It calls whatever function in here and some return values, or, well, values that were part of the structure, not explicitly a return value. But you'll notice down here after stream state, after this happens, you end up with this NW value being very large. You kind of have that get propagated through multiple calls and throughout basically the rest of the chain. So what's going on there, they notice like, hey, the stream state is doing something a little bit weird. And it turns out to be a pretty classic string processing bug. When you use the BCP, so the Adobe Binary Communication Protocol, or the tagged version of it, it does some string escaping. So it iterates over all of the read all the things out of the read pointer, that is this PR pointer here, iterates through that. For most characters, it's just going to write it out exactly as is. However, for some characters, if either it's in the escape list as a character it should be escaping, or if it's under 31, either way, the way it basically comes across a character that should be escaped, it writes a 0x, I guess control A here. For some reason I had 0x1 in my notes. Maybe that's right. Either way, it writes a flag value out. Writes that value, does an XOR with 40. So that's just making it turning any of these low values into a printable, because it's just setting the 4-bit. Well, 4-bit of the highest nibble. It's setting the bit there. It's making it a big number, or larger number. Anyway, that aspect isn't super important. It does the XOR. This is just how it does its escaping for whatever reason, and increments the pointer again. And of course, to make sure it's not going out of bounds, it will check if, or will potentially update the end pointer. It did two increments on the pointer, kind of your usual while loop here as it's iterating through. Under the normal one, it just does the one increment of the pointer. However, when it doesn't escape something, it of course writes twice, so it does need to do that. or it'll do the increment on that twice. So they'll try and account for that by limiting how much it'll actually read by decrementing the end pointer, which basically just tracks how far they're going to read. The problem here is that if this were to happen, so if the last character were to be the one that needs to be escaped, it's going to get through like the P less than end check. It's going to increment the pointer. So now in theory, it's pointing right at end. Increments the pointer, does this, and even though it decrements the end pointer, it's still going to go ahead and increment that pointer once again, now pushing end beyond the actual end of the buffer. I'm sorry, I kind of glossed over this, but part of the structural data that's getting passed in and why this end, or why the pointer being moving beyond the end matters, is because the way this thing keeps track of how much space is left in the buffer, so either how much is left to read or how much room it has left to write to, is that it has the pointer to the data, of course, and then it also takes in this limit pointer, which is just the end of the buffer. So when you end up pushing this pointer beyond the limit, when it does any sort of calculation, like subtracting the limit from, or sorry, subtracting the current position of the pointer from the limit, normally that's going to tell you how far you are from the limit. However, when pointer gets pushed beyond the limit, now that's just going to basically invert. You have another integer overflow, and you're going to have a very large value come out with this. So pretty classic on the string parsing issue to have like the last character causing problems, always being that weird little edge case that you have to take care of and be aware of. They tried to do a little bit of managing or making sure they don't go out of bounds, but they don't deal with the one edge case. And it's pretty commonplace for these sorts of issues to happen. I mean, string parsing in C is always so likely to create issues that it's always worth kind of fuzzing here.
Yeah, I was just about to say, this is basically a perfect target for fuzzing. Because, like, you look at this code and you can tell it is not fun to read. Like, trying to do manual assessment and catch this sort of issue, it's more likely to be found through fuzzing, is what I'll say there.
You have to keep the state in mind for a lot of it.
Exactly.
Yeah. In fairness, like, this is a pretty simple string parsing function. You know, like, this does fit inside just a few lines here. We've covered some of these string parsers that have so many edge cases and stuff to be aware of. This is a little bit simpler. It is a little bit more straightforward to do this manually. But catching them, like, it is a place that you should put extra attention to. But yeah, it takes keeping a lot of state in your mind and how that state might be violated elsewhere, or what violations might cause elsewhere. Getting into the exploitation, if you really want to get into all of the details for that, they go into a reasonable amount of details, but the gist of it is nearby in memory, or next in memory, basically, was basically the current stream structure. So that had all those function pointers I was talking about, so they can get control of, or get function calls with pointers that they can also control. Just before some of that data, the process structure, or the proc structure, there were some read-write pointers that they could overwrite. So they were able to get an arbitrary read-write pretty quickly to break ASLR and have the function pointers pretty nearby in memory without needing to go into much of the grooming aspect or anything like that.
Okay, I was about to ask, because I was reading through it while you were talking about it. I was like, did they really have to do much heap shaping here? Because it seems like that they got it pretty reliably, but yeah, I wasn't 100% sure on that.
No, my understanding is... I don't know if
they just glossed over it or what.
No, my understanding is they didn't need to do any heap shaping here because they're overflowing right into it, right into that stream structure consistently. So my guess is that stream structure, like, this might be within all like one larger structure that's containing the information.
It's basically an intra object overflow. Yeah,
like, I don't know that for sure, but given the fact that they don't seem to need any sort, like, there's no variation here that they bring up, that would be my assumption, is that either the allocations just always happen exactly as they like it, which is a possibility too, or it's one big structure that they're just overflowing within.
That's a third possibility to point out. Because, yeah, it depends on the allocator. Like, certain allocators, especially if it's just like a bump allocator, it could be way more predictable than, you know, you might think. But, yeah, that's kind of an interesting aspect to it, because it's not too often you see, you know, heap-based exploits like this that are that reliable, or at least appears to be that reliable. So that's a bit of a standout point for me from this blog post.
Yeah, I mean, exploitation was, I think, pretty straightforward in this case, or it seemed that way from reading it.
Yeah.
Although I guess they do call out their, I'm just reading towards the end there, it's still not reliable enough to exploit this vulnerability in the wild, so there's possibly something that we are glossing over in terms of reliability here. I'll admit, I was mostly focused on the vulnerability when I went over this. I did gloss over some of the exploit aspects, so you'll probably want to dig into that a little bit more to figure out what we're actually missing.
Yeah, I'm just looking. It seems there might be some other interesting factors on the reliability, because they point out that, like, their info leak is a little bit finicky as well. Like, the offset between the address you leak and the variable they're trying to hit can change depending on, like, the amount of arguments you pass and whatnot. So, yeah, I don't know. It might be something on that side of it too, but
hard to say. At the very least here, like, the gist of their exploit was the fact that they were targeting that just adjacent memory, didn't have to do the grooming, but it does seem like there are some other variables in play here, but they did have pointers that were being read to and are read from and written to that they could target. So getting the pointer overwrites like that to turn it into the arbitrary primitive, but you know, some details were missing, and they are probably in the post, just were missing from having not gone over absolutely everything in here.
Yeah. All right, so up next we have a follow-up to yesterday's secure point topic, which was assumingly an uninitialized read that led to being able to leak session IDs. And in this post, it seems there's another uninitialized read, which kind of leads credence to that speculation we had yesterday. So yeah, Z, I'll let you get into it.
Yeah, it was kind of fun to realize that it was a very, very similar issue to yesterday. So if you weren't listening to the bounty episode yesterday, we had basically a login system. When you log in, the response would contain a session ID. And that session ID, you know, in theory should be your new session if you logged in successfully. But if you didn't log in successfully, it would be kind of the last session that was successfully logged in. Or it would be the session ID for, like, that session. Which sounded a bit to us like a uninitialized sort of variable thing where it's just reusing whatever value happened to be sitting there before and wasn't being overwritten. And what turns out here is for their exploit here. So now if you do have a valid log, and so yesterday's, if you didn't have a valid login, you can kind of just do an invalid one, see what session ID you get back and take that. So in this case, now if you do have a valid login, you're able to log in, and then if you don't make any further requests actually using that session ID, so some sort of first-time initialization stuff gets missed, but you make that request, you're still going to get a response that keeps the normal response body, which includes the session ID. So it'll include that, but because you missed or haven't done some of the initialization steps, it'll leak other information. So they end up leaking like a pointer in here. They have another example where they fuzzed it or repeated it several times. They were able to leak an environment variable out of it. Let's see here. Session ID is OTP auth equals zero. Yeah, just an uninitialized use here, which is, it's kind of fun to see that on the web. Not unexpected, because this is like a C application, you know, running under fast CGI. So just a bad choice for web, but it's a firewall, so you know their history.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked before about how tricky it can be to get remote info leaks like this, so it's kind of funny seeing it in this sort of, like in the response body of HTTP requests like this. Like, it's not a common area you see that, but when you do see it, it's pretty cool, so.
Yeah, although just kind of shouting out one place where I've seen it happen a number of times, so that sort of remote info leak on the web, is images and image processing, where you'll end up getting some garbage dumped kind of into the data. Actually, now that I'm thinking about it, similar in a sense, like Acropolis, which we talked about a couple weeks back. Different, but you'll sometimes see uninitialized memory make its way inside of images. Like, that's probably the most common place I've seen memory dump, and that's just because, I mean, image processing is dealing with memory a lot, so it's just a likely place for bugs. Seeing it like this, yeah, it's really surprising, especially like a session ID as being an info leak is, you know, pretty great.
For sure. In terms of impact, this is probably something that you would use to chain with another issue. I mean, info leak on the web, you can sometimes get something useful, like maybe you can leak like keys or something, like some private like secrets. But that said, it seems like something where you don't really have much control over it. Like, you can't really influence where you're leaking, and you're not leaking like a ton of data. So it's going to be pretty situational how useful it is. But still, like I said, it's mostly cool that it was just found in the first place and it can be exploited like that. But being able to leak pointers can be useful as like, you know, chaining with something else. So definitely not to be ignored.
Yeah. And given the fact that this is like a C or C++ application, you know, it is likely that that sort of bug that you would want to chain this with exists. You know, you oftentimes in the web, information disclosure isn't necessarily going to be that useful because you're not dealing with like a memory unsafe language. But in this case, you are.
All right, so getting into a Project Zero report, Project Zero found a complex bug in the Windows kernel registry subsystem, which can create some like type confusion type situations. So we've talked about the Windows registry a few times before. It seems to be an active area of research for Project Zero, at least, especially in like the Windows registry. It gets pretty complicated. You have a lot of, you know, hierarchy and different trees and stuff like that. So, it's one of the more complicated systems of Windows. And one of the features they support is the ability to rename registry keys in place, which is facilitated by this NT rename key syscall. And it has to deal with a few edge cases. The prime one that's important here is the ability to deal with like not allowing name collisions and making sure that users can't redefine keys to existing key names. The problem that they had here, though, was that while they check subkeys, they don't check keys that have been created but haven't been committed to the registry yet. So in that case, when it goes to perform the lookup to see if there's already a key with that name, it won't find it, but CM rename key will take ownership over the existing key unconditionally, which can cause like a few different problems. The two ones they point out here is, well, I think they point out a few more than two, but the two that were like really stood out to me were it's possible for the rename key to overwrite various parts of the key control block, which could be used to derive some interesting corruption logic. And then the other thing is and like any errors triggered in the control flow for rename key can end up destroying that key control block with no effort to preserve the state because it's not aware that, you know, that key already exists. So the way they triggered like a crash or corruption with this bug involved confusing the key node's subkey counts, which is used when looking up the key list. So by creating two keys, renaming both to the same name, committing the transaction, and then subsequently deleting that registry tree, you can kind of cause like a desync with the count of the key list, making it going to -1, tries to translate -1 into a virtual address, which of course it can't, and it causes an exception. They don't go too much on, you know, the background details of, you know, all the nuances of how that works. And that's typical for these sort of bug reports. You know, it's not intended for people who aren't familiar with the code base, but yeah, like as usual, it's a pretty complicated bug coming out of the Windows registry. It's got a pretty cool nature to it, though. You know, that idea of having a key that's not been committed but is created and causing like a confusion there. Pretty fascinating root cause. So yeah, I like this one. I'm not sure how exploitable it would be. It seems like you would have to do quite a bit of work to be able to get useful corruption primitives. And you know, where it's a bug report, they don't really go into that too much here. They just kind of pock the crash and move on. I would be curious on the exploitability of it, but yeah, I can't really speculate too much on that because it's a complicated subsystem, and the primitives that you'd be able to derive from that are going to be pretty specific to the context. So
yeah, and I feel like any exploitation on it, like, you're going to have to dig deep into understanding the registry internals, which of course Microsoft doesn't make public, so you've got a lot of kind of overhead to exploiting this. That said, like, as a bug, like, you keep referring to it as complex, but I think it, like, the bug is pretty simple and almost elegant in the sense where it is just create a key under the transaction, rename it, but don't commit that, and then under the same transaction, just rename another one to it. Like, it's just abusing appropriate state tracking in a sense. Like, it does get a bit more complex, especially the details of it can be more complex, but at its root, like, it's a very simple logical bug that, like, you can imagine somebody testing a very similar sort of thing in, like, a web application where you know you've got, like, these states where it's you can, you know, start a transaction, make some changes, and maybe commit or roll them back or something. You know, you could see that in a web app, and you can make this very similar sort of test case, only in this case we're resulting in memory corruption, which is neat to see. It's a very logical bug leading to memory corruption. Yeah, I don't know. I really like this bug. I've liked a lot of the work that they've been putting out in the Windows registry, although a lot of it does, you know, go over my head on the details there. The root of the bugs, like, there have been some cool stuff being found here.
Yeah, just to elaborate a little bit on why I called it complex. When you get into more of those state level issues, like, I think it is fair to attach that, because a fair number of the issues we've seen, especially lately, have been, you know, your more bog standard, they just don't bounds check it, or the bounds checking is wrong. Whereas this is more of a state level issue. It's not something that you could just stumble on very easily from fuzzing, I don't think. Like, you would have to think about how the subsystem is architected and think about all the edge cases that could crop up. So that's kind of where I was going with the complex part of it. It's just that it's, you know, in hindsight, it might seem a bit simple, but at the time, you would have to be thinking about...
Well, that's the difference between, like, discovery. Between discovering the bug and, like, the bug itself. The bug can be simple, whereas discovery wouldn't necessarily be simple. That said, I don't think you're wrong to call it complex either. Like, I'm not saying that. Like, there is a degree of complexity, but that can kind of be glossed over as we're covering it, I guess. When you mentioned fuzzing, though, to trigger the bug, you know, they mentioned here, it's, you know, create the test key or rename one, but don't commit it. Rename one to the same name, commit it. That feels like steps that a fuzzer could do to at least trigger the bug. You would have to be doing, like, registry-specific fuzzing, doing these registry actions and fuzzing it like that. But that does feel pretty possible for a fuzzer to me.
A specifically targeted fuzzer could find this.
Well, I mean, yeah. Targeted in the sense of, like, it's targeting the registry. Not, 'cause, of course, like, with most bugs, if you know where the bug is, you can reproduce it. But this idea of effectively, like, the key thing that would need to figure out is just to rename with the name of the key it just created. Like, it would have to know to reuse the name. That feels like a constraint the fuzzer could do.
Possibly, yeah. I won't say it's impossible for a fuzzer to find it, just that it's more likely to be found through, you know, the manual review. And I think that's actually, you know, as I like to point out with the Project Zero reports, they do have the methodology there, and they say they found it through binary review. So, yeah, not too surprising there. But like Z says, you know, if you have the fuzzer architected the right way, you could find it that way as well.
Yeah, like, I don't know if anything that's just fuzzing the registry like that, to be clear. I don't know if anything that, maybe there is some that does that fuzzing, but to me, it feels like something that if one were targeting, like, the registry, it could be, but... Again, I have, like, there are details here that just go well over my head, so I could very well just be missing out on some of those details.
So the other thing I'll quickly add on there before we move on, they did have to do some, like, work to try to trigger a crash with this. So it's not like, you know, you create these, like, get a key renamed to the same key before it's committed, and just you cause a crash. You kind of have to do a good bit of work to cause that. So that's good another point. Reason why I think it's a little bit more unlikely to be found through fuzzing. But yeah,
that's a really good point, actually. I think like the root bug could be detected, like could be recreated. But yeah, actually, I wasn't thinking about that. But when you need to trigger the bug check specifically to get that crash, yeah, that's a good point. That's going to limit the accessibility by fuzzing because it does need more than just those constraints.
Yeah. Getting into something that would be probably found through fuzzing, we have another Project Zero post. This is one of their O'Days in the Wild series by this post was found by Ned Williamson. And yeah, so it was a zero day found in the wild in the Apple SPU kernel extension, which is used for managing drivers on macOS and iOS. Unfortunately, couldn't really find what that acronym stood for. Might be Synergistic Processing Unit, like the PS3. I'm not sure. I spent a bit of time, but yeah, just couldn't find anything. But regardless, surprisingly straightforward bug, considering it's coming out of Apple. Typically, when you see the Apple O'Days in the wild, they're somewhat complex. Yeah, not really this one. So getting into it, the SPU extension has a method called async message, which is the message handler for, you know, async messages going to the SPU. They have various opcodes that they support, but the one that's important here is the allocate buffer opcode, which can be used to allocate a buffer inside of this Apple SPU object. And it's not allocating from the heap or something, it's allocating from inline slots in the object. So you can kind of, for those who can see the stream, you can see they have this Apple SPU struct, and then they have an array of 16 buffer entries, which is where it's allocated from. And yeah, they just don't really check to make sure that you don't try to allocate more than 16 of those entries. So it'll just it'll keep allowing you to allocate. You can see it's doing this pointer math on the buffer to calculate the entry pointer. And yeah, there's no bounce checking. So you can just get an allocation outside of that slice and get a pretty straightforward arbitrary or out of bounds write primitive, which you could probably turn into arbitrary write fairly easily. So yeah, like I said, it's surprising to see such a straightforward vulnerability here. I guess it's just an area that hasn't been combed over as much. On top of that, I think this probably would make for a fairly straightforward exploit as well, because like being able to allocate a buffer out of bounds and get that returned to you, typically, you know, you're going to be able to read and write to that buffer with pretty few limitations. So I don't imagine it's too hard to derive some useful primitives here either. So yeah, they don't really comment on that too much. They link off to a survey of recent iOS kernel exploits for, exploit strategies for iOS in general. But yeah, they say exploit not available. They weren't able to analyze that part of it. But yeah, I imagine it was fairly nice for an attacker. So
yeah, sounds kind of like an interesting post. Would be a pretty nice place to be in for the attacker. But yeah, it is interesting to me that the exploit wasn't available for some of those in the wild. I mean, it happens plenty of times where they report that, but I don't know. When you have it in the wild, I feel like part of being in the wild is that they do have an exploit for it.
Just get a crash log or something, then that's just going to indicate to you like the initial point of corruption.
Yeah, true. So depending on what they got.
Yeah, can only really speculate on that. Yeah, like I said, a fairly straightforward and nice to understand bug on the Apple side of things, which doesn't always happen, as people who follow the show for a while probably remember. Yeah, so that's all the topics that we have. We do have some shoutouts. I'll let Z get into one of them here, and yeah, we'll go through them and wrap up the show.
Yeah, our first shoutout here, compromising Garmin sport watches, a deep dive into Garmin OS and its Monkey See virtual machine. Pretty much what it sounds like. Multiple vulnerabilities, something like a dozen of them. But key thing here is a deep dive into Garmin OS and Monkey See, their virtual machine. A lot of background information, which I like to call out when we see kind of these deep dive posts into some random topic that I've never had any reason to look at a Garmin device or to look into it at this level, but perhaps you have, so kind of wanted to shout it out. A lot of the vulnerabilities were fairly straightforward. It's not really not really much to cover or shout out here, but still, a lot of the background information could be valuable if this is an area of interest to you.
Yeah, it's also got a bit of cool, like a cool factor where it's dealing with a custom language, because the operating system has like its own language, and they go through reversing that and talking about, you know, its implications in the security space. So yeah, it's got some cool stuff on that as well. Another shout out that we have is from Thallium, and it's Fuzzing Guide to the Galaxy, an attempt with Android system services. So yeah, it's basically an overview of like system services in Android and targeting them for trying to find bugs. They talk about like looking for a good attack surface, mainly looking for like C and C++ based services and looking at what you can reach, and then building a fuzzer based on trying to reach the, you know, various message handlers and stuff inside of the services. Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is like, there is some good background info here if you're not too familiar with like the Android service model. It does get a bit complicated and it's not documented super well, so it's definitely worth checking out for that. And they do detail a few of the findings they had there as well. So yeah, if you're interested in fuzzing and mobile sounds like an interesting space to you, this post has a lot of cool information, I think. And then, yeah, finally,
In terms of the fuzzing, like, it is something a little bit different from just the Linux kernel fuzzing that you might get with when you look up about Android fuzzing, you know, going through syscaller and stuff. Syscaller being the common Linux kernel fuzzer, so applied over to Android too. So it has a bit of a different spin than a lot of the content that you see too, which is nice.
Yeah. And then finally, we have a post by NCC Group, Stepping Inside System Management Mode. This is sort of looking at similar things to what I was looking at with PSP, though. Here they're looking at, you know, Intel CPUs and system management mode. They go through a fair bit of background info here. They mainly talk about exploiting through system management interrupts. So yeah, again, some cool background information here. Vulnerabilities weren't super interesting. They were, you know, some more of the low-hanging fruit style issues.
Sort of thing that we see when you get deeper into, like, similar things what we'd see with, like, hypervisor exploits and the hypercall exploits, where it's like they don't check where they're writing or reading from or something like that. Yeah, the bugs were low-hanging fruit because it's kind of a difficult area to get to.
Yeah, one of those hard shell but soft inside once you understand the area and can start looking at it. So, yeah, it's definitely worth it for some of that background info. So that's why I wanted to shout it out. And yeah, I mean, it's a cool area of research. It's where I've been spending some time lately, though on the AMD side. So yeah. All right. I believe that's all the shoutouts we have for this week. So unless you have any last minute thoughts, we'll wrap it up there.
Oh, that's all.
Cool. So thank you everyone who tuned in. If you want to catch any past episodes, you can find recent ones on Twitch, and all of them are on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and more off Anchor. Also feel free to join our Discord and follow us on Twitter. Links for those are down below or in the chat as well. With that said, we'll see you next week.